First of all, welcome. I'd like to thank, I guess, both of you, Will Tour and Michael Cook, for they're sitting around the corner here, and they do the recording that's made and played on KSKA later on during the week. And those can be downloaded from their website, which is kska.org. And today I've asked our executive director, Lisa Falsco, if she would do the honors in announcing our guest speaker. Lisa?
Thank you, Rod. It is my pleasure today to introduce Kirk Talbot, and we actually have something in common, so it's an extra pleasure. And it's not that we were both married in a small church in Palmer that our spouse's grandfather built. That would be him. And it's not that we both went to Yale. That would be Meade and Roger with Kirk. And it's not that we're both master chess players. Well, that would actually be neither of us, because apparently his good friend Roger Benedict is the master. And it's not that we both began our careers practicing international law in our bikinis. I mean, Bikini Atoll. That would be Kirk. And it's not that we're both in our 40s. Well, that would be me. It's that both of us had the same predecessor, Barbara Propes. Barbara led the Alaska World Affairs Council for 20 years before heading to Washington, D.C. to lead the national office for over 2 years, and now is preceded by Kirk. Kirk Talbot joined the World Affairs Councils of America in May 2009. He brings almost 30 years of experience working with communities, governments, and humanitarian organizations in international development, environment, human rights, and security. After grad school and a year traveling around the world with Roger Benedict and losing chess game after chess game after chess game, he began his career practicing international law in the field of nuclear testing litigation in Bikini Atoll. Mr. Talbot then spent 10 years at the World Resource Institute as manager of World Bank and USAID-funded environmental action plans in Africa, and then the first regional director for Asia. He worked in conservation in Asia the next 5 years, leading in the design and execution of strategies to protect biodiversity and community rights to resources, fundraising, and advising several foreign governments. Mr. Talbot was president of First Voice International, a nonprofit organization working across Africa, Asia, and the Pacific from 2003 to 2009. In those 6 years, he rebuilt and led a nonprofit, First Voice Africa, and its new operations in Kenya, which leveraged satellite and community radio and ruggedized computers, solar, and other technologies to provide knowledge-sharing platforms to millions of remote Africans and Asians. Mr. Talbot Hall has also been a guest teacher at Yale, Georgetown, SAIS, George Washington University, and yesterday, South High School here in Anchorage, where close to 100 students were in attendance. He has published widely and has served on several nonprofit boards. As a member of the DC Bar and a graduate of Yale, Mr. Talbot has a JD and a MSFS from Georgetown University Law Center and the Foreign Service School. This afternoon, our topic, Linking Environment, Human Rights, and Good Governance, Overcoming the Development Divide. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Kirk Talbot.
Thank you very much, Lisa. And special thanks to you, Rod, and John Wittes, who's on our national board and representing Alaska wonderfully in terms of the growing national organization, and with Keith, who's going to be the new head of the board of directors here. So I really want to thank all of you. I want to thank the board of directors of the organization, many of whom I met last night, and proved to me once again what just a wonderful resource this World Affairs Council system is for our country, especially today. And thank you all of you who took the time on your busy schedules to come here today, and I really appreciate the opportunity. I would like to give a a fairly quick kaleidoscopic view of a few of the experiences, few of the observations I've had over the last 30 years in Africa and Asia on the front lines of development. But I'd like to go fairly quickly because I'd like to have plenty of time for discussion and conversation, and I also would like to be a little provocative here. So if check and challenge each other is always a good thing. So I just want to mention Alaska is special for me. My bride is from Palmer, third generation, and we did in fact get married in the Presbyterian Church in Palmer. And I'm going to go see her 90-year-old grandmother this afternoon with my aunt, Jerry, who's here. I'd also like to say that I am a FOM. You all know FOM, friend of Mead. Friend of Mead Treadwell. Mead arrived at our prep school where Roger and I went, and I was president of the Current Events Club, a very prestigious East Coast thing. But Mead quickly, as soon as he entered the campus, became a real leader in high school and college, and certainly professionally here in Alaska and nationally. So it's great to see you, Mead. And I look forward to also hearing some of your talks around the council system. He had 1,500 people listen to him in Naples, Florida just last year. So it's really exciting, and he serves you well. And of course, Roger, I'll leave aside a couple of the comments. And by the way, I'm in my 30s now, early 30s, so you being in your 40s is something else. Roger, we'll have to have a little time for a chess game this afternoon because I have been practicing. Okay, well, what I'd like to do, I'm going to talk about the World Affairs Council at the end, but let me, I don't want to rush this, but maybe leave you hungry for more slides and I can stay after to talk further. But I just want to present, sort of a kaleidoscope of some of the frontline issues. But I have three myths that I'd like to dispel and sort of to structure the talk. And the first myth is that environment is a sector of its own, it's in a box. And I will propose that environment is everywhere and everything. And I will try to have many slides to suggest how the environmental challenges we face overseas and, of course, here in this own country are completely integrated into health, human rights, governance issues. And I know most of you are buy into that, but I think that that's an important lesson across the world. The second myth is that with climate change and a lot of what we're going to see here is that things are pretty desperate and, in fact, warrant despair. And I fundamentally disagree with that. I've seen so many wonderful, productive, constructive initiatives, individuals, organizations working overseas, and you're going to see many of these here, and often they're under the radar screen. You know, the bad news of environment is in the press and all, and it's really important for us to look a little deeper, and that's the beauty of the World Affairs Council system, is to educate and engage in these so that we can have a more nuanced and a more a richer understanding of what's happening in our world so we can be better citizens. And then finally, there's be a bit of a mention about the myth of self and the individual, and I might be treading on thin ice here in Alaska, but my thesis is it's all about community and cooperation, and it's really the self is a problem more than a solution. So let's just jump right in. As I say, if you can't hear or you can't see, please raise your hand or let me know, but we'll put on your seatbelts here, and we're going to have a little ride through Asia, and then we're going to look at Africa, and then finally come back home to the United States with our World Affairs Council. The first slide is self-evident, and a lot of the work that I've done has been in the Asia region as well as East Africa, but it speaks for itself. And the, you know, again, this is a very sophisticated audience, but the point is that with demography being such and population growth being such, that there's a corresponding decline in the natural resource base, and we all know about this, but this is a pretty dramatic photo, and this is 10 years old or more from the World Resources Institute, where I used to work. And this shows the remaining really forest cover, and a lot of that is secondary. So it's really pockets that you have in Borneo and very high up near Bhutan that you have really sustained old growth timber, but it's getting very, very desperate. And if we hone in here on Southeast Asia, you can see quite an interesting correlation between, this is the forest cover and shade. So in Southeast Asia, you have most of the forest cover in the Burma-Thai border, up in Laos, and up here in Cambodia, while Thailand is almost completely deforested. And if you look at the forest cover and then look at the population density, you see a completely reverse, inverse relationship. Here's the population density, very low population here in Cambodia, Laos. Laos has about 5 million people. It's two-thirds the size of Vietnam. Vietnam has over 70 or 80 million people now. Thailand, 60 to 70 million people. 10, 12 million in Cambodia. It's rising rapidly after the genocide. And then Burma, a lot of the tribal groups live around here. Now, very quickly, I want to just address an important legal issue. I'm an overeducated idiot. Lisa was kind enough to go through a very generous introduction. But frankly, the more you travel and the more you go around the world and visit with the village leaders, you realize how we are, in some ways, handicapped in our own education system because we've lost a lot of the traditional knowledge. 100 years ago, there was a court case that's actually one of the most important cases in the history of land law. The Philippines was a colony of the United States. And Oliver Wendell Holmes, the Supreme Court of the United States, who had jurisdiction over the land issues and all the legal issues in the Philippines at the time, came out with a startling decision on a lawsuit that was brought by a plywood company, a logging company, in the early decades of the early 1900s, against a group of what were basically forest-dwelling pygmies that lived in the Philippines, who had been there since time immemorial. And Oliver Wendell Holmes gave the forest dwellers the rights to the land that was in question. This is over 100 years ago, and he established in that decision the concept of ancestral domain. And that says that if people have been there since time immemorial, their rights to the land overcome any rights sense, including what was the Magellan Doctrine. When Magellan arrived in the Philippines, he planted the Spanish flag and virtually assumed authority over the entire landmass of the Philippines. And this has happened in many, many other countries. And then when colonialism ended and the new nationalism took place, that paradigm of state ownership endured. Today in the Philippines, thanks to the work of Peace Corps people and students like we have here that we celebrate so much, and a really active legal community in the Philippines, that concept of ancestral domain is enshrined in their constitution. And now, worldwide, indigenous groups are working on trying to sustain and strengthen their rights to the resources. And John, just our discussion last night about John Wittes' leadership here in this state with some of the native corporations, it's really fascinating. Issue, and there's a lot that we can learn from each other. This is a picture from Burma, and Aung San Suu Kyi won the Nobel Prize. She's the only imprisoned Nobel Prize, Peace Prize winner. I'm taking our two daughters into Burma this summer. We're not going to swim across the lake to see Aung San Suu Kyi, but we're going to actually try and write articles and go online and do some blogs about what it's like in this repressive society. Let me just mention three things about Burma. They need some marketing help. So if any of you know good marketers, Burma needs it. They had the government was called the SLORC, State Law and Order Restoration Council. Well, they did hire a marketer and then for $500,000 a year, and she helped them change their name to SPDC, the State Peace and Development Council, a nice Orwellian euphemism. But they still need some work because the main prison in Rangoon is called Insane Prison. And their PR effort to show the United Nations and the US government that they were trying to work with the tribal groups in the border areas, they came up with the Border Areas Development, BAD, not a great acronym. So, there is some amusement there, but there's an incredible tragedy occurring right this minute in Burma. thousands upon thousands of young ladies are being raped systematically by the armed forces. There's dams being built in the eastern Burma that are flooding out tens of thousands of villagers. Please go online. Just look up Burma human rights, whatever you want. Look at the YouTubes. The reason I'm mentioning this is because while the problems with the environment are clearly related to the dam building and the militarization of the country and the human rights abuses, we need to also understand how then we can address a country like Burma. And really, frankly, I'm clueless. I'm one of these rare people. I guess I get out of Washington enough to admit that I just don't know. I don't know the answers to a lot of things, including what to do with Burma. Secretary Clinton is trying to get some dialogue. I just am clueless. Maybe you all have some ideas. But the point is, we are not going to address the environmental destruction that is ongoing very rapid in Burma right now, including the devastation of wildlife. I don't know if there's any tigers left in Burma, and they used to have many, many, because of the sucking sound into China for their exotic culinary tastes. And the forest situation, too, is really in a very, very bad place with Thai and other loggers going in. I might mention when I was working in Cambodia and Burma about 15 years ago, there was quite a phenomenon. During the day, the Khmer Rouge would be fighting the Phun Sen Pek and the government forces. And in Burma, same thing, you'd have the ethnic groups fighting the Burmese junta. But often at night, and I wrote an article on this with another colleague, and we could document that the same warring factions during the day were having beers at the local bar and doing colluding on logging, illegal logging contracts at night. Literally, warring factions, and then doing the illegal logging to fund their arms and all this. So it's a whole perverse, complex equation that we have. Human rights, environment, corruption, governance issues, and of course, when you have this kind of rapid deforestation, it unleashes all sorts of health crises. We know that HIV/AIDS might have had a relationship to the deforestation in Central Africa. Certainly malaria, which I've had a few times, has a relation to this too. And the poverty is essential. So this is just to lay out a bit of the threat equation. And I want to now just touch on how we're trying to address this. What I've seen on the front lines in terms of addressing this complex equation. This is a picture from Cambodia in an area called the Cardamom Mountains, where the spice cardamom is famous from. I worked years ago with a team in which we actually employed guards, armed guards, to stop poaching. Now, this is very controversial in many places in the world. And I frankly believe that there's a time and place for most everything. And sometimes you have to fight fire with fire. And there's a fellow named Woody, who I met, who was the head of these armed forces that were anti-poaching. And believe me, this is the kind of guy that you want by your side. He was trained in Russia. He was a serious military intelligence person and very disciplined. And quite frankly, that's the only reason I believe that the Cardamom Mountains might have tiger populations, might have original forests 10 years from now, is because of well-trained forces like this. Again, very controversial. But we're getting to that equation where we have to start looking at creative and new approaches. So the vicious cycle of frontier deforestation relates, of course, to population displacement, migration, land clearing, farming, and then degradation of the soil base. People move on, slash and burn. It's a vicious cycle. So to address it, the Asia Development Bank, international NGOs, but most importantly, the growing body of local NGOs are coming together to look at a natural environment approach. This word GMS relates to the greater Mekong subregion. It goes from Burma to Vietnam. So the approach that's being developed now looks at the weak political will, looks at the economics and the population growth and the national development agenda, and understands the threat equation in terms of infrastructure, industry, trade, and then tries to put together an environmental framework that addresses poverty first and foremost. Because just like in your state, and just like in many parts of our country, it's that economic imperatives that's in conflict with preservation. So we found that dressing upland imperatives, just like in this, with the watersheds versus the flat areas, there's a whole different agricultural policies and trade policies. We really need to think import substitution, rural credit schemes, microfinance, as you were talking about earlier today, looking at enforcement and infrastructure and market policies. This is exciting. To me, I get thrilled, actually, because the problem seems so big, and yet, and then we throw our hands up, but yet they're human created. So why can't humans address them? And of course we can. We just have to be disciplined, creative, and work together. So there's actually quite an alliance being built between governments and regional organizations. And I worked on an article or a chapter in a book with an Asia Development Environment head, and was on good dams and bad dams. And you know, a lot of environmentalists think all dams are bad, but if you lived in the region, you know, you can't take for granted the importance of energy. So these large dots here represent the sort of power grid foci for oil, energy, electricity, hydro, and the whole transportation corridors being built now are looked at very much like in our country with environmental impact assessment, social impact assessment. This is very exciting and very new to a region where it was just kind of cowboy development. This is not to suggest it's getting, you know, a panacea, but the approach is very strong. And of course, geographic information systems are very powerful. And with just like what we do here, I mean, with Google Maps and things, a lot of these technologies are being employed overseas. Training is happening. Resource development is now being looked at within the economic framework. And a lot of good is being done. I really want to emphasize that. You don't see it on the news. And if you're interested, I can give you some documents that can really back this up. Now, this is a quick slide of Aceh. And I have a little video. We can maybe show it later. It's 2 minutes long. I'd rather not do it now. But it shows a program that we had using satellite radio, like XM technology, to beam down from a satellite system. This is with my work with First Voice International that owned part of the electromagnetic spectrum for satellite radio to use for humanitarian purposes. So we'd put up on the satellite hours of Bahasa Indonesia or Acehese language information on trauma relief, on agriculture, on sanitation. It was developed in a studio after the tsunami that was built really quickly, and within weeks, 300,000 people were getting this local language information that was life-saving. And they powered the local batteries for these local satellite radios with bicycle power. So you have satellites and bicycles. This is excellent. This is a combination. This is bringing together technologies and approaches. So quickly, I'm going to go to Africa now, the bright continent of Africa. And this fellow, Shikuku, is a Luo. He was the assistant director of the National Outdoor Leadership School for all of Africa. Knowles pulled out of Africa after the bombing in Kenya. But he has since developed a program to bring together warring tribal youth, the Kikuyu, the Luo, the Kalenjin, who were killing each other in mass battles a year and a half, 2 years ago in Kenya. And he set up an NGO to bring these tribal youth together and use the wilderness of Kenya as a textbook, as a backdrop for people to learn to work together and survive together. And he's been having some real heyday. And by the way, he was up here in Palmer for months. He got his original training 20 years ago with Knowles, I think up in here in Alaska. So he's been here several times. He'd be a fabulous speaker for you, Lisa, too, if he comes back here. That's my daughter here. We went on a trip, and these are folks from Colorado who come out to help Shikuku. This is just a picture of a disabled children's home where Ava and I went. And you see the smiles. It's really remarkable. Again, one of the great things about our council system is that we are opening the window to the world. But there's no substitute for travel, and all of you know who've traveled how inspiring it is to see the smiles and the faces of tragedy and that sense of can do, which we tend to kind of cry into our beer in this country. These folks, time and time again, you see the resilience and courage of the Africans. Couple slides here from Rwanda. When Ava and I were in Rwanda last summer, we walked out of the Holocaust Museum, and there was a cement pathway from here to that window where you all are back there. Buried underneath there were 350,000 people's remains, almost all of them killed by machete in a span of 3 months in a country with 8 million people. And that was just Kigali. That was just the capital. I worked there for about 3 or 4 years with the Tutsis, who were the tall folks who were outside the government because I was working with the NGO sector. When I went back to look for them, I couldn't find one. So that's a tragedy of epic proportions. But 50 years later, Rwanda is the least corrupt, the cleanest, one of the most invigorated economies in all of Africa. The public health situation has just improved dramatically. 50% higher rates of survival from diseases, and an extraordinary conservation program as well, where you can see here, you know, they have 250 mountain gorillas 7 feet away from you. You pay $500 a person for 1 hour to be with these godlike creatures. And that money is some of the best money I've ever spent because it goes to pay not only for the guards and not only to protect the ecosystem, but the majority of it goes for schools, and clinics, hospitals, education. And so the Rwandans have really learned. And this is an important lesson. Every challenge, every disaster holds in it the opportunity to learn and to improve. And hats off to the Rwandans for what they've achieved. Finally, we're here at the Lord's Resistance Army. Could anybody raise their hand if they've heard of Joseph Kony or the Lord's Resistance Army, child abductions in Uganda? Okay, well, we were fortunate to go there, and the northern area of Uganda was infiltrated by these horrific group called the Lord's Resistance Army, abducted thousands of children, and recently, in the last 2 or 3 years, they've been kicked out of Uganda. That's the good news. Bad news, they're now in 3 other countries, right this moment, abducting, burning, and pillaging. Jolie is the head of Invisible Children. When I spoke at the South High School yesterday, Invisible Children is an NGO started 6 years ago, and they're very active. They now have 12 high schools they're working in Gulu, Uganda, under Jolie's leadership. And she used to be a sex slave and child soldier under Joseph Kony. Somehow, this remarkable woman who was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize and who I hope to bring to our national conference possibly next year, has led an effort where literally thousands and thousands of students and villagers are now reclaiming their lives. This picture shows heads of households, these women who give 10 to 15 cents a week. They put it in a box from their collective savings and individual savings, and collectively, within a month, they're able to buy farm equipment that can double their production with irrigation, and then the whole community achieves that. Then the next round, they'll be able to put 30, 50 cents a week and build up like this. This is microfinance. This is the way of the world that's most encouraging. And when we look at the population explosion, the poverty, and the relationship with energy and environment, this is very important. And again, it's wonderful to be here and to celebrate your students and the outstanding work that this council's doing with education, because here's every one of these girls are former child soldiers, probably all of them former prostitutes, child prostitutes, and look at them now. So, and you know, this is the result of two filmmaking college students from San Diego starting an entire movement in northern Uganda with Jolie and the people there. So these are the kinds of things we don't hear enough of, and I just wanted to leave that with you. There's a phenomenon of hundreds of thousands of school children, girls, who are picked up by men in their cars after school. They have sex, and men pay them so that they can afford their books and school fees. It's a very, very prevalent phenomenon. I'm not talking tens of thousands, it's hundreds of thousands across Africa every day. Now, you see this kind of advertising, and this is just kind of the equation, part of the equation, because personally, I feel, if I was asked yesterday, Lisa, by a student, what's the most single important thing to solve some of these? And I think right at the top of the list is education for girls and women. Guys have been drinking and gambling for too long. We've had our chance to run the world. And at least in my household, with two strong-willed young ladies and all, I believe not that men have to step aside, but that we have to understand that at this time in history, it's time for a different approach to controlling the world and controlling our resources and trying to manage with a little bit more of a sense of sacredness to our resource base. So finally, whoops, how did that get in there? The World Resources Council, World Affairs Council, our mission is to engage in the critical global issues. And here in Alaska, you all are an extraordinary phenomenon. I couldn't believe, Lisa, when I heard that this council started before Alaska was a state. You have 50 years here. That's remarkable. And our original mission was to transcend the isolationism after World War I, because people were terrified by the consequences of that world war. And so what we've seen over the last several years is a growth in this phenomenon, this mobilization of nonpartisan activity across the country, and you know, reacting to international events. And this is hard to see, but this is a growth in our membership through the last 90 years, and you see how it relates to World War I, World War II, the Vietnam War. And I mentioned to the board last night that I had the distinct privilege of interviewing Ted Sorensen from the John F. Kennedy's special advisor during the Cuban Missile Crisis and for years at his house. He's blind now. He's a remarkable man. And he said to me that the World Affairs Councils of America has the most important mission of any organization he knows of in the world. And that, you tend to listen to a man like that who's seen the history he has. And I asked him why, because we should be a modest organization. No way should we be arrogant. We can do a lot more than we're doing now. The national office needs to strengthen itself. We need to be much more supportive of the work, of the volunteer work and the hard work that you all are doing, and 90 other councils. I just found out Rochester is starting World Affairs Council this year, as is Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. So we're growing rapidly, and yet we need to be modest because there's a lot more to do here to form alliances and partnerships with other organizations. And when we look at the healthcare debate, if you want to call it that, the vitriol, the accusations, the meanness, and just the breakdown of civil discourse, I saw at least, I am so gratified to be part of a nonpartisan group of thousands of individuals across this great land who disagree vehemently often. And you have right-wing Republicans and left-wing Democrats, and it doesn't matter, because we understand we need to debate and engage and pull together. So I'm going to just finish up here by saying that I don't want to do an advertisement for us. I'm delighted to be here and to see what you all have going. I do want to say that Alaska is special. I have special roots with my friend Roger and Megan, Megan Gould, Roger's better half. We lived in Indonesia for a while, and so we've had, you know, when I look around the room and I've seen the kind of people that are here in Alaska and the interests that you have, I actually see this state as a real leader in the country right now. You are a bridge. You're so unique, and you have such fabulous resources, and I just see that Alaskans have a perspective on the world that's very important. So it's a delight to be here, and I'd like to take any questions, and I thank you all for the opportunity.
To what do you attribute the success in Rwanda?
Well, good question. You know, the way the good Lord works sometimes is disaster. Out of disaster comes something wonderful. And, you know, it was such a horrific event, and it really shocked the Clinton administration, among others. I mean, that was probably one of the low points in our foreign policy in that decade, our behavior, and certainly the French and others, oh my goodness. But I think that the trauma was so severe and was kind of like the trauma of World War I. Out of the ashes of World War I, like a phoenix, 25 councils popped up across the country within a year. After the Holocaust and the genocide of Rwanda, I think it shocked the psyche of many of us, and particularly the people there, and they said never again. And I think it was partly in reaction to that. I really don't know. That's my guess. But I think the international community also rallied partly out of guilt for their inexcusable lack of attention during that Holocaust. So I think there was a rallying internationally and a coming together. And plus, some very, very bad people were pushed over the boundary. But remember, 4 million people have died. It's the largest death grouping since World War II. 4 million people in Eastern Congo, and much of that has been caused by the exodus of the Hutus and the militia from Rwanda into what was Zaire and is now DRC. So I showed on the map this. No reason for us ever to get cocky in the international community. No reason to rest. And that's why I really believe Ted Sorensen is right. The kind of interest that you show and the fact that these young students from Brazil are here and taking a year and having the courage to come and live with the family here, and the excellence of your students and all of you to be engaged, this gives a lot of hope. I didn't talk about the third myth, so I'm just going to throw that in. I said this yesterday, I think the three most dangerous words are me, me, me. And I really have gotten to the point where I think when people ask, what is going to change things, it's letting our self-centeredness, collectively as a nation, individually, and even within communities, try to let go of that, and let's make the connections. Let's listen a little better. Let's reach out. Let's drop our biases. I'm not preaching here. I'm just speaking from my own experience. You know, you go to India and Pakistan, you go to Bangladesh, you go to Rwanda, and you start seeing some of the problems these people face as opposed to our problems that seem so serious and deadly. And if these people can rebuild, and after what happened in South Africa with the Truth Commission and these kinds of things, we need to open our hearts to each other. I believe, and I think the environment and all these complex of problems, that's the first condition. So sorry for the long-winded answer there. Yes, please, in the back there.
Kirk, thank you very much for giving us a sit rep on where things stand around the globe. Can you tell us a little bit about where does the international debate sit about dealing with failed states? I mean, what's going on at the UN, the OECD, NATO, the other bodies that, you know, could potentially intervene when these things happen? Where is that debate?
Right. Thanks. That's a great question. And again, you know, I'm an expert in nothing. Truly. I don't know the answer. But I can tell you this. I would refer you to the Stanley Foundation. Just look at the Stanley Foundation, Google it. They have a whole big program on failed states. They're also a partner of ours at the World Affairs Council. We're actually partnering with them for a national conference, Jonathan. I meant to mention this to you. And they're actually pushing to have a feature in our national conference on November on failed states. So I can't give you a good answer right now, but I could point you towards something, and maybe we can talk later. Personally, I believe that I'm not talking black helicopters here, but I really believe that it's in our national security and certainly the international community's national security to move in. I'm going to give you one example, because that really is an important question. So I can't answer it per se from a government perspective or even from any particularly wise, but I can give you some anecdotes. One anecdote. 1992, I'm a token lawyer on one of the first UN fly-ins to Cambodia that's just recovering from the worst ravages of the Khmer Rouge. And we're setting up the Ministry of Environment. I'm on a small team. And I was with the editor of the Phnom Penh Post, who's a wild man who started the newspaper in a very dangerous country in a very dangerous time. Fabulous guy. And he was standing next to me while we were in downtown Phnom Penh, and the United Nations soldiers, 20,000 were, well, not all of them at that time, but they had 20,000 in the country, but they had a sort of a parade through downtown Phnom Penh with these gigantic military vehicles and really large African blue helmet soldiers. I'm talking 6'4" and pretty fierce looking Ghanaians with AK-47s sitting on top of massive military machines, and they were rumbling through the streets of Phnom Penh. And Mike, I was standing there, you know, I don't travel with cameras anymore because I want to have the direct visual and the experience. But Michael, I'll never forget it, was standing next to me. He said, "Kirk, these two guys to my left are Khmer Rouge soldiers." And he would know. And so I looked at them. He wanted me to look at them. And both of these guys, who are real killers, both of them were shaking. They were so scared. The idea of these, you know, black, blue-helmeted, large soldiers rumbling through town from this international community totally changed the dynamic. I felt so exhilarated. I loved to see them wet their pants, you know, on their way to jail. And so there's a lot to be said for international intervention, and I think that's a great question. Thanks for asking. I'd love to follow up on it sometime. Come to our national conference, maybe. You'll see more. Please, in the very back.
A very inspiring talk. I've been a member of since for about 48 years, and in that time, the association spent a good deal of money sending me brochures on their guided tours of around the world, which are easily beaten price-wise by a number of other companies. And my question is, given what you've been describing and talking about, why isn't there more interface between World Affairs Councils and opportunities for service-oriented tripping around the world that might, among other things, encourage a growth in the younger membership of the World Affairs Councils?
What a great, thank you so much. And can we have a hand for the gentleman with 48 years experience? Really, it's people like you that just really make me thrilled to be part of this mobilized network. I'm not sure the answer there either. For one, I'm a big guy on business models, and another one of the most strategic words in the English language is no, in my opinion, to stick to what we do best. Now, that being so, we haven't traditionally done that. We do have Philadelphia Council, Lisa, as you know, and we've talked about, has a robust international travel programs, and I'm sure some youth go on that. So I would refer you to the Philadelphia World Affairs Council that's kind of outsourced some travel. Second, we have the leadership missions, which I guarantee you will not find a more competitive price, because they pay for airfare, and they pay for everything in the country, and they introduce you to the president and the ministers. And we just had a group go to China. Fabulous. About a $5,000 value. You pay about $850 for the processing fees, and that's it. Taiwan, Azerbaijan, Kurdistan, and Sri Lanka. I've had dinners at each of those embassies with the ambassadors the last 2 weeks. They're all lining up to organize leadership missions for our councils. But I don't think that relates to what you're saying about a more work service program. And let me take that back and share that with our board. Jonathan, I think that's something we might even consider. And particularly when it comes from such a outstanding member with the longevity. And I think that's something for us to consider. But at a minimum, what we could do is put on our website the several organizations that specialize in that right now. So thank you for that, and thanks for your service to the organization over the years. Yes, ma'am.
There's been a kind of quiet scandal in Washington about the family on C Street, the fundamentalist religion organization that has housed congressmen for below normal rent prices, and the connections of this religious group with overseas dictators and their belief that people in power are there because God wants them there. And part of the research they did was their funding or support of some of these religious people that have these child armies, and I wondered if you knew of any of those connections.
I I've heard a little bit. One thing I have heard recently is about some support for anti-gay legislation, including the death penalty in Uganda. I think some of you, are you referring to some of that? I really don't know enough about them. I think that's pretty abhorrent. And at least it's gotten quite a bit of press. And here's an example where the internet is such a remarkable resource in terms of knowledge sharing. I'm sure because there's enough press. I do understand just in the last week the Ugandan legislature stripped that bill of the death penalty and might even strip the bill altogether. So I can't comment too much further on that. But I did, I did want to suggest one thing that we touched on yesterday. Just, maybe sort of as a sort of conclusion. This, I believe, and please check and challenge this, especially the young folk. When I talk around the country, I hear so much desperation, despair, hopelessness. And because it seems so complex, and really we need to dispel that. And one of the things that I believe and I've heard, this anything I say is that there's nothing original. It's all from what we've observed and heard. But I've heard enough now, and I actually buy into this. I think this is the first time in human history that we actually have the wherewithal. I'm not talking about the political will. I'm talking about the science, the technology, the capacity to address every single major threat to humanity. And that was not the case. If you read about the history of science, it's remarkable. 150 years ago, where science was not only medieval, it was practically ancient. When you think about transportation, up until the steam engine, people traveled by horseback and cart, just like they had for thousands of years. So there's been this rapid rise. Now, of course, the problems and challenges have risen with it, with the nuclear age, with pollution and terrorism. But at the same time, and we lose sight of this, and for you students, just hold on to this. This is a remarkable. We can address the pandemics. We're working with the World Quest sponsorship with a pharmaceutical company that might be on a multiple virus killing drug. HIV, AIDS, malaria, and other things. It could be a breakthrough. I have no idea if this is true or not, but they're already at the mice stage they've had 3 or 4 years. Whatever the case, we know that there are approaches here, but it really requires political will, and it requires a positive attitude. Please, anybody else in any, please, sir.
Thanks, we need the inspiration. I've been hearing a lot about the emerging carbon markets, mostly in Europe, and some of the interesting market-driven possibilities for combining the problems you're suggesting, the environment, economic development, poverty. Are you seeing anything that's emerging, by using the carbon markets to address these things?
I used to be much more of an environmentalist. I've sort of become a generalist now, and with my human rights work and governance work. And I think that's a fascinating area. I've become increasingly agnostic about carbon trading and cap and trade and all this, because it just doesn't seem like it addresses the fundamental enough. I was with the head of the Cleveland Foundation just a couple weeks ago, and he was describing to me a plan to put 140-foot tall windmills on Lake Erie, and to bring in whole new services. And I'm not this doesn't directly answer your question, because I'm really not qualified to, as an economist or even an environmentalist, to address the pluses and minuses of cap and trade and carbon sequestration and all, even though I've been immersed in it for decades. But increasingly, I'm not sure that's doing it. Kind of trading one for another. When you look at the CO2 concentrations, when you look at the geometric curves we're on, we need a paradigm shift. That's the only time I'll use that word today. I don't like that word. Most overused word recently. But we really need a fundamental shift. And I'm not advocating anything. That's just my own personal opinion. And I don't think the cap and trade. Now, that being said, the market force writ large is unassailable. And everything relates to value proposition and money in this world, everything, every single thing. So the market is an incredibly important force. I just believe that countries such as China that are spending multiple times more than we are on renewable energy right now, and they're going to be ahead of us in the market, and our standing globally is in jeopardy. I strongly believe that, and I'm not talking 50 years from now. More like 5 to 15, we're going to see if our deficit and our debt crises remain, and we don't make a shift with political will towards some of these renewable technologies, we're going to be left behind. So sorry for an incomplete answer to you. Please, ma'am.
Thank you. Just a comment and a question. I want to come back to Rwanda and Burma. I think in terms of Rwanda, One of the reasons, in addition to the organizations that said we failed in not recognizing the problem and we want to do it differently, was the president and the administration who came in. I mean, I've met several of the people there from that administration. I've worked in Rwanda. That kind of change, that kind of genocide and ethnic violence had been going on for decades, unfortunately. When we see the chaos in the Congo side, you can see the difference. I mean, there's no structure to try to enforce that. I guess the question I have about Burma is that I think that the bad acronyms just show how out of touch that administration is with the outside world. It's probably better than if they had some very, very benign, positive sounding descriptions of entities that are really not that at all. But I wonder if you're saying, because you think you would go in personally and try to blog from there, and I'm curious to see whether you think you'll be able to, whether that kind of personal engagement is what you're advocating, or whether you see some more international or approach to engagement as opposed to boycotts. Because as you say, the markets, the Chinese and others are well willing to buy all of those natural resources despite concerns we might have, and to perpetuate the regime that is willing to do that kind of business and doesn't have to apparently rely on the West at this point, or believes it doesn't.
Thank you for the comment. Excellent question, and I concur with you. India and China are now competing for Burma's resources. China's trying to get a pipeline into the Andaman Sea, and they also want a seaport. And they're increasingly owning Burma, the forests. And a lot of the work that I did looked at the transportation infrastructure being developed with Asia Development Bank money. And check this out for a nexus of issues. The logging trucks, okay, they build the roads up to China to siphon the logs, old timber, up into China, because China had a logging ban in 1998 after $40 billion of damage from the floods. So they had a total logging ban, and guess what's happened to Southeast Asia's forests in the last 10 years, and Africa's. And box turtles in my home state of Maryland are going near extinct because of the Chinese market, too. So this is a real global phenomenon. But I think that, frankly, I don't know what. I mean, for 20 years, I've been trying to help on the Burma side of human rights. And I know the people are most engaged. Earth Rights International is very active and has gotten lots of funding. And it's just because of the geopolitics, the United States is decreasing influence there, just like you say. Frankly, this is sort of how I'm seeing it. I think the junta there is dabbling in nuclear technology right now. They are looking at, the sort of that equation, right? And when they go off that line, then the blue helmets might come in. So, that might be one approach. It's really, as I said before, you might know a lot more than I do about it. I'm perplexed, I'm baffled, and I'm very saddened because there doesn't seem to be an answer there. We've tried so many different approaches, including the United Nations envoy, for years and years. So if anybody has ideas on what to do, and I think the World Affairs Council Network would be a good resource to raise some of these issues and maybe even try and get an iChat discussion with Aung San Suu Kyi. That might even be possible if there's leverage on that with some of the councils. So it's a great challenge for us. Thanks. Yes, sir.
You've mentioned the United Nations a few times.
Right.
Could you address their effectiveness or suggestions or for improvements with the United Nations?
Does anybody work with the United Nations Administration in this building? You might think that I'd be a total booster of the UN. I certainly am in principle. My father was a World Federalist after World War II. He came back and helped join the World Federalists, which might put him in the black helicopter category for some people. But I'm very proud of my dad. He's 90, and he still today sees the importance of world citizenship, not above American citizenship, of course. I actually think this network of ours is one of the most patriotic bodies I've ever encountered. But I am very disappointed time and again with the ineffectiveness, even hypocrisy, of the United Nations programs that I've seen. In particular, UNHCR and some of these others that are on the front lines, they do the Lord's work, and there are many individuals on the front lines who dedicate their lives and are real heroes. They happen to make about 15 times as much money as a lot of the heroes you never hear about for the NGOs that are, you know, giving their lives to this. But the bureaucracy is practically crippling, and just this back and forth. And look at the problems in the places the UN has been. And if you dig into it on the internet, you take a case like refugees in the Congo, I just think there's a whole lot more that we should be demanding as U.S. taxpayers. And I'm not talking sort of the Jesse Helms rat hole rap. But I personally feel there's a whole lot of improvement that needs to happen, and that the United Nations should be much more accountable to good governance systems. And I think there's nothing wrong with putting pressure on them to do it in a constructive way, and understanding it's an absolutely essential body. But just like all of human governance issues, and really everything we've talked about today, in my opinion, everything comes down to governance. And that's why the importance of not just the individual, but the nation state now has to think of governance evolving because of the globalizing threats and opportunities. And I think your question is really important, and I'd like to see actually our network think more about the United Nations in a constructive manner and give best practices ideas to them and improve their performance markedly, because millions and millions of people depend on them. And that's not to diminish their mission or the heroes that are on the front lines, and many of the leaders. For instance, I forget the fellow's name that Samantha Power wrote about, who died in Bosnia, you know, one of the great peacekeepers. I mean, they're heroes all over the system, but it's become so bureaucratized, politicized, I think it needs a something of a house cleaning.
Are your organizations getting financing from, like, oil companies and the people that want the good PR? Is there a connection between getting financing from them and getting the micro loans and microcredit and some of the needs met in the third world?
I thought your question was going in a different direction. It reminded me of something I heard at another nonprofit I worked at, which is tainted money, taint enough. But your question is more serious. We have both Exxon and Chevron are on our national board, for example, and actually they're fabulous partners. Diana Sedney from Chevron and David Bailey from Exxon are very, very important leaders, and I look to them for guidance and all sorts of insight, and they provide very important financial support to our national office. And if you don't have gas in the gas tank, you're not going to go very far. And we all of our councils need funding, and Lisa and I met with some corporate representatives here the last 2 days, and they very warmly received us. But I think that the business community has a increasingly important role to play. And this is the point I guess I'll leave you with, is the connections, that we're all in this together. This is one of the great opportunities of globalization, this historic threshold that we're on, where we really can address these issues. But we have to pull together. We have to demand more from the bodies that are representing of us. And I believe the most important thing is listening, learning with an open mind. And I guess I'll end right there, because this council and Lisa's leadership and Rod, what you've done, and John and the whole board of directors and the many, many volunteers of this council, this is where it's at. Because if you start here with your home community and with the internet and with travel and globalization, if you can imagine right now, across the United States, there are over 90 councils like yours, some that have 5,000 members, Jacksonville, Illinois, with 12,000 people, 30 miles from the Peoria World Affairs Council. Jackson, Illinois has like a few dozen members, but they meet every month. And so I just want to end by saying, keep up the great work. Let's work harder. And thanks so much.